Do not adjust your radio frequency. This is not a test. This is the Artist First Network.
Welcome to another broadcast of Bigfoot Central on the Artist First World Radio Network. Since last century, Artist First has been bringing you programs about Bigfoot and a free platform for the free exchange and expression of ideas. And as always, we want to hear from you guys. Send us your questions and comments to dj@artistfirst.com. They're both back with us tonight and they have a guest. I'll turn things over to MK Davis and Don Monroe.
Well, Don, where are you right now?
I'm at a very bad place to talk on the phone. I just moved my car about 25 yards. I'm at the Craters of the Moon National Park region over in the flatlands of Idaho, a 100-mile square unexplored region actually is, and it's lava flow, and there's Bigfoot stories here. A lot of them. I'm checking out the local boys in the water holes.
Do not adjust your radio frequency.
Are you hearing any stories?
This is not a test.
Yeah, I got one. I got one from an airplane guy, and that's just today. I got this. Is it we on radio now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're on the radio.
Oh, well, I had a fellow today tell me this up here at the Mountain Home Air Force Base out there. He's been flying, and he says they looked down and saw something bipedal walking across the desert areas out there adjacent to Craters of the Moon. I had the same reports years ago. I wrote about those things in that way I did years ago, and it was 2001 and 2 and 3 in that area. But anyway, there's new reports here every once in a while of something being seen out here, and a lot of different animals for food out here, and it's a very unlikely place for most people who are into Bigfooting, who think they are, and it doesn't just take the Coast Range Mountains to see these things. It's out in the middle of nowhere, too.
Well, they seem to hide in some of the most unlikely places.
Well, they go to the food plants where they go. That's where it's at, and sanctuary, you see.
Sanctuary, I think, would be a big thing.
Yeah, it's very important.
Yeah, Jason, welcome back to Bigfoot Central. We're glad to have you back. We were kind of in the last time we had you here, we were kind of in the middle of things, and just getting to the meat and potatoes of intervention theory, and we ran out of time. So I'm glad you were able to come back. Let's see, where were we during the last show? And you had to forgive me because I had to work today, and I just got home. So you're trying to win a little bread for the table.
Yeah, but the last show, you mean with Valente, or was the one I had last week?
No, the Valente, when Jason was on last, and it's been several shows back, yeah. So
Jason,
actually, I missed the last two shows, so, you know, you've been.
Yeah, you have.
That's how things have been for me. But, you know, life goes on. This nearly impossible task of finding out about what a Sasquatch is and discovering one officially in spite of you know, all the time you put into it, you still have to eat, and you know, you still have to put bread on the table. So you know, you kind of work this in around it, Jason, can you refresh me where we were? I know we discussed Anunnaki, I don't think we discussed Uhuru Mazda, and I read that on the internet. Who was Uhuru Mazda?
Say that again. I'm not sure I understood the word.
I may not even be pronouncing it right, but it's symbolized by a pair of wings and somebody in the wings, you know, descending from the sky. Uhuru Mazda, it was some kind of a god that the what was it, the Sumerians?
You might be referring to Marduk.
I think they're both different names for the same thing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, there was a lot of different symbology in the cuneiform tablets. Many of the depictions that we see in the Sumerian artifacts show winged figures, which ascribed deification to those representations. And so, from what I understand, it definitely seems that that even in the Old Testament, when you're referring to the Elohim, the translation into that text was from those from heaven who came down below, something along those lines, and which meant that they flew, they came from above. And I think that there's plenty of evidence to show in some of these ancient writings, whether it's Sumerians or other ones that are contemporary or a little bit newer, depict the gods as having the capability of flying. And we do see that all throughout antiquity, winged discs and bird men, you know, we've seen those, especially in the Egyptian culture.
Well, let me ask you something. Why are they portrayed as bird men? Why not portray them as in their craft? Is that due to a lack of understanding as to what they were seeing? You know, maybe with primitive minds or inexperienced minds, a misinterpretation of what they were seeing, you think?
Well, I would say all the above. I think it just depends on the culture. You know, if you think about it, if you lived back at that time, there were probably many species of birds in the sky, and you could equate what you saw in the sky with a bird. And so therefore, if you saw a craft land and people getting out of it, I think a person's perception at that point in time would think, oh, well, then they must be like part bird and part person, you know. And so that's the way they represented what they witnessed, because they didn't, you know, they couldn't watch Star Trek and Star Wars back then and identify it as you know, an advanced type of rocket ship, you know, and then, you know, give it a proper definition. So it makes sense to me that we see all these really different, almost sometimes confusing depictions of things in antiquity just don't make any sense. But if you can expand your awareness and think and even entertain the possibility that if we were seeded by an advanced civilization, and if they were spacefaring and they flew in ships, that the humans, now whether, you know, and the debate is whether or not humans are indigenous, and I follow the line of thinking that we are definitely a hybridized product of hominoids and the beings that came here. So we were sheltered from knowing a lot of truths on purpose so that we would be easier to control. And that's, to me, what the Sumerian culture represents, is that they were basically just reporting what they were seeing, but, you know, their frame and their frame of reference and the context with which they put things in was very limited. You know, it's not like they had privy knowledge to how, for instance, the Anunnaki had advanced technology. I'm sure that, you know, the humans just weren't given direct information to let them know how everything worked. And so a lot of what we see is just to the best of their ability to describe what took place back then.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, if that were to be the case, and we were hybrids, what is a Sasquatch? Is it the original stock, or is it something in between, or what? Where do you see the Sasquatch in all of this?
That is probably the most important question that any of us in this field can ask ourselves, because I think inevitably this is going to be probably the biggest bone of contention that anybody would have when they get into doing this kind of research. Just off the bat, I'll tell you what I think it is, and then I'll explain why I believe it to be so. I believe that hominoids, you know, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, were an indigenous being to this planet. And the Anunnaki, being a very advanced civilization, came here, and they, according to what the cuneiform tablets interpreted by Sitchin say, they got tired of laboring. It could have been the gravity. There could be a lot of different variables as to why they did what they did. But it makes sense to me that they basically needed to do a lot of work, and they needed to come up with an answer because everybody was getting tired and frustrated. And so the chief medical officer, Nin Hirsag, came up with the idea of integrating the DNA from the existing hominoids that, you know, blanketed our planet and incorporating it into their own. Now, I can't give you percentages. You know, Lloyd Pye and I have had discussions about this, and, you know, his best guess is probably like around 15%, and that's an arbitrary number. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, we seem to look mostly like the gods. You know, apparently the Anunnaki look quite a bit like us. I mean, I've heard them being described as, you know, tall, Nordic-looking, blonde hair, red hair, blue eyes, green eyes, and just very Northern European-looking. And, you know, Sasquatches, as you know, come in a variety of colors. Their hair color and their eye color is debatable. But the percentage, I think this is the way it boils down to. I think it boils down to is that hominoids are indigenous to this planet. Anunnaki come here and eventually, you know, create the first strains of hybrids. Well, where it gets really, really complicated is that there seems to be this situation where members of the Anunnaki, we're talking full-blooded Anunnaki, started to copulate with these hybrids, which could have been, you know, more hairy. You know, there seems to be some evidence to support that they may have even been like half-breeds, you know, half Anunnaki, half Bigfoot. And so these beings would have been very, very stoutly built, you know, very hairy, and maybe the Anunnaki, apparently from what I've read, it seemed like the males wanted the people in charge of the hybridization project to create more hybrids with a little bit more Anunnaki DNA to make them more appealing to have them as partners, sexual partners. And so, you know, as crazy as it sounds, it seems like what it boils down to is that, you know, the human race was basically created for slavery and as sex toys.
Now, this is found in the Sumerian cuneiform accounts of creation. Is that right?
Well, what I'm talking about is Sitchin's interpretation of the cuneiform tablet. So if you pick up the book, The 12th Planet, or Genesis Revisited, you know, Sitchin wrote a whole thing called The Earth Chronicles. But basically, those two books deal with this issue that I'm talking about, and it's basically what did the Anunnaki do when they got here, especially in reference to hominoids and creating a hybrid race of beings being us humans. It's all in Sitchin's work.
Let me ask you this. Do you find personally that this is in conflict with what the Bible teaches, or how do you view that?
That is an excellent question, because I actually study to be a minister. I was born and raised in the Christian faith, and I got to tell you that when I read Sitchin's work, you know, and if I wouldn't have seen a Bigfoot, I wouldn't have gotten into any of this at all. I would have stayed a Christian. But the problem that I had and the points that Sitchin makes are so well defined and put together and packaged in challenging that it's not that the Bible is wrong. It's that the way that the Bible was interpreted, you know, you have to go back. I mean, everybody has, I think probably the whole listening audience has played the game telephone. And you know how, like, you got everybody sitting in a horseshoe with their chairs, and you whisper into the one person's ear, and by the time it gets around the room to the last person, you could have said, you know, chocolate milk spilled on the floor, and by the time it gets to the 12th person around the U-shaped set of people sitting there, it's going to be elephants invaded North America. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of
right,
like...
Right. I've played that game before. I've seen it work much like that.
Exactly. And this is the point that I think Sitchin makes beautifully in his work. And he does something that I call word mapping. He's very, very good at showing, you know, in the cuneiform, as we proceed through time and go through this evolution of human culture and go from Sumerian, you know, Babylonian, Akkadian, Phoenician, Egyptian, Hebrew, all the different cultures, he will show you and network, you know, really, really important keywords for those languages that describe really significant things in those cultures, like rockets, blood, humans, like what the name, like it's funny that in cuneiform, Adamu is the same as Adam in Hebrew. And, you know, so there's a lot of words that Sitchin shows you. Well, you know, when I read the Bible, you know, I read it from front cover to back cover three or four times in before I was 25, and then through Bible college. And when I read Sitchin's work, and because I took Greek and Hebrew in Bible college, his thought processes and the logic that he was presenting was so, to me, was so sound. I was like, oh my God, this makes so much sense what he's saying. Because I've read, you know, I've had my Strong's exhaustive concordance out. I've looked up the words and the root meanings in Hebrew, and he clearly lays it out and shows you that these words go back in time much further, and they refer to something from a much older culture. And so I forgot what your question was originally. Personally, my thought, the Bible, see, if you interpret the Bible in the light of what Sitchin has been saying, everything starts to make sense. Like even in Genesis chapter 6, they talk about the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair. And that, you know, I remember being a little kid and sitting in the congregation hearing that and going, oh my God, what was that? That sounds like a sci-fi movie.
Oh, right. It's something that seems to be out of place there. You know, you're talking
Absolutely.
About spirituality and qualities, and then all of a sudden there's a story of beings that came down. And,
right.
and had children with the daughters of men, and they were the Nephilims of old, the mighty men, the fellers, they call them. That I can see how that would kind of set you back. But, you know, it's was already there in the Sumerian text, was it not?
Exactly, and that's what most people don't understand, is that this has been around for over 100 years. But what a lot of people don't understand about archaeology is that archaeology was only first—it only first got going as a science or a discipline, I should say, in the 1860s, and it was commissioned by the Catholic Church. Well, if you got a bunch of Catholics and Christians digging around in the Middle East, pulling up artifacts, if it's not in alignment, if it's not congruent with their belief system, then it gets thrown in the myth pile with the Egyptians, Greeks, and the Romans. Because we all saw in school what they did with that stuff. It, you know, oh, there's no such thing as Mercury and Adonis, and there was no Minotaurs. There was none of this stuff. It's all mythology. It's all make-believe. None of that stuff was real. Well, what if these people in antiquity were just reporting what they were seeing? And that's what made me stop in my tracks, you know, when I read Sitchin's work. You know, he has said it himself. He's not so much an archaeologist as he is a reporter. Because when you go back and you reinterpret the cuneiform tablets in a non-Christian way, you get a very different story. And that was the problem in the 1890s when Kramer and Kramer first started translating the cuneiform tablets, is that it was through a Christian filter. And so it went directly into the myth pile. It was completely just leapfrogged and it just dismissed completely. But then when Sitchin started studying it, you know, I guess 50-plus years ago, you know, charts of our solar system, and they counted the planets from the outside in. You can't get that perspective unless you're a spacefaring race of people giving that to the humans. I mean, there's just no way they could describe Neptune and Uranus with such detail. I mean, it just had to have come from an advanced civilization.
Yeah, I'd like to point out, or at least you know, make a statement about the Christian. You know, what Christians perceive to be the truth or the facts of the matter. You know, in the past, down through the ages that Christianity has existed here on the earth, you know, there have been time periods when they have been very intolerant. There have been time periods when Christians have suffered much from intolerant people. So they've kind of known both sides of the coin. It's not necessarily the way of Christianity in general to be intolerant. Some people that claim Christianity might be intolerant, and they might, you know, actually, you know, destroy or burn books or burn papyrus or any of those sort of things. And we've lost quite a bit of knowledge through that method. But it's not something that God told them to do. is something they felt like they needed to do, and were wrong. It's not every Christian person that thinks like that. There are many open-minded Christian people who would acknowledge that the Sumerians had texts similar to the Bible, creation stories similar to the Bible, and many of the Bible's older, the Pentateuch was from older documents, perhaps even Sumerian documents, you know.
Exactly, yep.
Facts are facts, and there can't be two sets of truth. You know, it either happened a certain way or it didn't. In the course of trying to dig in and trying to glean from the facts that we have available, you know, we're not going to get everything right. But if we have the view of, you know, trying to find the right path or trying to go down the right road, we're going to get some things right, and we're going to build a little mass of knowledge that's going to be correct, and we're going to build on that. And that's the way man has always done. He's built. Jason discovers something, and MK comes along, discovers something that goes with that, and then next thing you know, Don Monroe comes along, and there's something else that sort of jibes with that, and then before long, we have enough a little body of knowledge building.
You know, I got to cut in here one place. The Roman games of the arena, you know, the killing of the Christians and so on for over 700 years, actually 900 years undocumented. But you imagine how long a time that is, and how many people were killed, and how many possible entities may have been entering the arena too that has been somewhat documented, and hairy people from the Eurasian mountains and forests. Now, you know, we don't know exactly what they did, but that's a long time. That's longer than the United States has even been here, and you can fathom that in your mind's eye of all the bloodlet and all the merciless killing that went on in this world, and what they might have butchered, and even the animals that are unknown today that scientists say are 30% haven't been found. Now, that's interesting too. I just heard that the other day from a scientist. And, you know, that's the case. That means man and beast. I know whatever it means to me and you. But then, Jason is correct. A lot of things are written very anciently in ancient texts, including in Chinese texts. We analyze those a little more if you can someday. But there's a lot of things out there.
Then the older you go back, the farther you go back, the more you get to centering on the origins of these different ones. So you may weave your way through China or to Mongolia or back around to India, and it eventually takes you back to Samaria, just about. Is that not correct, Jason?
Yeah, it definitely, well, at least in that area of the world, like around Persia and then north of there. What's interesting, though, is that there's even evidence in India that India has writings that go back even further than the Sumerian cuneiform tablets. And Michael Primo's work with Forbidden Archaeology, and he's also written a book called Devolution, and he does excellent scholarly work to show that we have information going back thousands of years. I mean, way back, much further in time than we thought in the last 50, from what archaeologists have been providing us as far as their viewpoints on timelines. And so, you know, overall, what we're finding is that, you know, civilization as we know it can go back 35,000, even up to 125,000. And like Sitchin says, is that probably some of the first earlier human settlements were 180,000 years ago.
And now, this would be modern human, right? Not a hybrid, but...
Well, but modern humans are hybrids. I mean, we are all of us are hybrids everywhere. And which it would explain the difference in races. You know, you look at the Asian people and the Aborigines and the Africans and the Europeans and the North American, South American. How do we get this diversification of genes reflecting in human beings? It doesn't make any sense when you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint. There had to have been something, which is why I kind of got going in the last show, and I'm going to say it again, and I really hope everybody that hears my voice will go to Wikipedia and look at chromosome number 2 in human DNA, because it shows the telomeres smack dab in the middle of chromosome number 2 when they're not supposed to be there. And the only way that you can get that is from hybridizing that organism, us. So, you know, there's the evidence right there staring us in the face. And anybody can go on to, you know, I'm not talking about going to some black project website where some dude that's, you know, wacko crazy, posting all kinds of crazy, fantastic, information that's, you know, that's just science fiction. This is real stuff, you know. We know from looking at our own DNA, our own chromosome number 2 shows us, it's very strong evidence that we parts of us have been hybridized. And this doesn't show up in any monkeys or gorillas anywhere. It's only in human beings.
Right. So how do you see Patty? What do you see Patty as? Is she 100% Sasquatch, non-human, or non-hybridized, or... Is she something in between? I get different looks, you know, when looking through the film. You know, there are times when she looks absolutely, you know, a normal human face, just with hair, you know. And then there's other times, you know, when you see things that are extraordinary. You know, there's some clearly a normal human being as we know them today doesn't look like that, you know. She's all covered in hair, and you know it's something different about her. So, is she in between, or is she the original stock, or she's a purebred hominid? What do you think?
You know, MK, that is an excellent question, and I really don't know what she is. But I will say this: I will say that here's where it gets even more complicated, is that, you know, if these stories are true, like Xana, we've all heard about Xana, and they found Kavit, her son, in the Muslim grave, and he showed signs that obviously strong Neanderthal traits. And, you know, we have stories. There's been, I mean, even where I live in Bellingham, you know, golly, it's 7 miles from where I'm sitting right now. I've talked to elders at the Lummi tribe that have said, yeah, there's, you know, been matings between, you know, our ancestors and the stick people, is what they call Sasquatch, and it produced offspring. Well, that makes it extremely interesting, because what that does is it opens up a whole Pandora's box for all kinds of hybrids. Because I think you and I have talked about this before in just private conversations. You know, my reports are divided 50-50. I get people that say, no, well, you know, I had a nose that, it, you know, is almost like a Roman nose or like a Native American nose, and it very, very human-like features. And then some people are like, no, it's absolutely Pongid. It looked like a big gorilla or a chimpanzee. Personally, you know, the one that I saw, it was much more on the simian side of features. But I get a lot of people that say that it looked more human. And so that just seems to support more evidence that we're dealing with multiple different types of hybrids, you know, because if we're compatible and humans have been abducted over time from different tribes in remote parts of, you know, different countries and continents, then there could be, and God knows how they would express in the progeny of the Sasquatch. I mean, it's like, I don't know.
You know, Jason, I've always said for 30 years, and I wrote it down to prove it, but I've said this for 30 years and it's still ongoing, that I've seen evidence of at least 4 types of possible Sasquatch identities that they put out there. In a lot of places, I get this, well, you know, reasonably often, and this is an interesting thing, because they're, like you say, the region and the DNA, the amount is allowed to go in different directions according to the areas and so on. It would make a difference, a big difference in how they look.
Yeah.
Let me take a minute here to encourage the listeners to go to the Artist First homepage. And down there is the menu for the Bigfoot Central show. It's a button, third one down on the left. If you click on that one, it'll take you to the Bigfoot Central page. And let me do that. Okay, and then when you go to the Bigfoot Central page with the flashing on-air sign, you'll see it's got for tonight's files, click here. And if you'll click there, there's an interesting animation that I wanted to show you. It's right up at the top. And this is the combined effort of myself using this really wonderful frame 352 that I got from Patricia Patterson in the form of a 4x5 transparency. Probably the very best quality that anyone's ever seen out of coming from the film. And what I did was I took the area along the torso under the arm that was free of hair, and I cloned that skin texture all over her body to see what she would look like without hair. Well, digital artist William Mays saw my rendering, and he took it a step further, and he drew in where the muscles would be. And he came up with a really compelling image of Patty without hair. It's probably 90-something percent accurate. I wanted to make sure that the listeners were able to go there and take a good look at this, because it may help you to decide, you know, in your own mind what you're looking at. Very, very heavily muscled, very stockily built, but human looking, human, you know. So I don't know, you know, there's nothing there to disqualify it from being a human, I guess is what I'm saying. It's even unusualness doesn't do that, because there are unusual humans, and we don't label an unusual looking human an animal. So there you have it. So folks, whether we're looking at our past or our future or the present, I don't know, but it's a very odd and unusual looking person, a Sasquatch, and not a suit, which, you know.
I seen the picture 4 weeks ago, MK, when you first brought my attention to it, and I've had thought a little since with that picture and how much evidence that would be to anybody with our rocket scientist intelligence, they'd realize it's absolutely what you say it is.
And
no doubt about it.
I've got some more links for some other really good stuff from the Patterson film up there, but I don't want to take too much time away from Jason, because we're getting kind of, you know, to the really good stuff and the meat of his theory, the intervention theory, or not necessarily Jason's theory, but the theory of quite a number of people. Let me ask you, who is Eric von Däniken?
Well, Eric von Däniken was probably one of the, biggest and notorious authors. You know, he came out with Chariots of the Gods back in the 60s. And this is all before I was born. And, as far as I know, this is my take on von Däniken. And I guess what happened was is that he got really excited about the artifacts and, you know, sharing with the readership, you know, everybody. I mean, he sold lots of copies of his books because he definitely had something going. I mean, I think von Däniken did a beautiful job in bringing things to the table for consideration concerning ancient astronaut theory. All these artifacts, it's just how, if we evolve, if evolution is true, which is what's being peddled in schools almost as truth. It's like sometimes you can't even convince science teachers that you're teaching a theory here, and they want to say that, well, this is the way it is on Earth. You know, it's just there's too much evidence to support that everything's evolved, so we just need to accept it. Well, what von Däniken showed is that, well, if that's true, how come we have cell phones and all this advanced technology today, and then all of a sudden we have this Dark Ages, and then we have all these artifacts that we're finding from the Sumerian culture and surrounding cultures in antiquity that have super advanced forms of technology that should not have existed at that point in time? How do you account for that? And that was the thing that he brought to the table that blew people's minds wide open. But I think where he got into a problem, and this is my opinion, is that I think he got a little bit excited and may have embellished some things about what a lot of these artifacts could have represented, and I think made claims and assumptions that basically wound up discrediting him. But, you know, if you Google him now, he's made a huge comeback, and I think he's been forgiven and has been much more conservative in, his approach now to, because there's other authors, you know, like Sitchin, and, I mean, you have Cremo, and you have Graham Hancock with Fingerprints of the Gods. There's a lot of other authors now, you know, and you got Giorgio Tsoukalos with his show Ancient Aliens, you know, which I enjoy very much, because they're bringing things to light on a scale, thank God for technology, but they're bringing things on a scale now for public understanding. And, you know, all the 3D modeling that we're able to do now, and scale artifacts, and, because
plus
we have...
They shoot on location in a lot of places, I mean, all around the world. They may go 10 places in a single show.
Exactly.
that, yeah. That was not available, you know, in the distant past. So I remember when Dr. Vrindonikin came out, I remember that she used to, had it on the theater, and I think it was part of a double feature or something like that. And I thought to myself, you know, well, it just does make you wonder. You know, it sounds fairly reasonable. You know, it's we know that we came from somewhere. You know, everything has an origin. We have 360 degrees around this planet, wide open space. There's a lot of stuff out there. You know, the biggest impediment to believing is that we haven't been able to traverse it, so we assume that no one else could. But that's, you know, that's what is time, you know, what is time immemorial, way back. Time is distance. Am I not correct? Time, yeah, and distance are both manifestations of the same thing, miles per hour. So that if you're able to shorten the time that it takes you to travel from point A to point B, then you're effectively also reducing the distance. Yeah. And if some entity, some people, some alien, whatever you want to call them, is able to transverse point A to point B in this big, wide, open universe that we live in, then he shortens the distance, and it's not as far as it once was. Yeah, that's part of Einstein's grand theory that has been proven to be 100% correct, that time equals distance.
Yeah, and if you belong to a race of beings that can do such things, then it's in all likelihood that you're going to be viewed as a god.
Well, you know, I remember reading when all the miracles were occurring there in front of Pharaoh by Moses, the biblical account, that it said in the Bible that Moses became a god unto Pharaoh. And, you know, you think back, you know, Pharaoh probably was pretty impressed by, you know, turning the Nile into blood and the plagues of gadflies and all that. So that he associated them with Moses, so Moses became a god to him, you know.
Right.
Even in the Bible, it uses that same analogy. It didn't say Moses was the god or was the great god, but it says he was a god unto Pharaoh. So with a little g.
Right, yeah. Yeah, when you read the Bible, especially the King James Version, you don't get so much with the NIV because that gets into man's interpretation, but it's nice to read the King James Bible alongside with Sitchin's Earth Chronicles, well, especially the 12th planet, especially the flood account. Moses in cuneiform is Zuasudra, and that story is very clearly explained by Sitchin. And, you know, that whole concept you're talking about, God with a small g, and why that is. It's absolutely, I remember the first, you know, when I was handed that book, The 12th Planet, I think I stayed up for 24 hours straight and read the whole thing. I couldn't put it down because I remember having questions burning in my mind for years and years and years and years. And my hat's off to Sitchin because he satisfies the questions that I've always had enough. And I'm not saying that Sitchin says is gospel, because I disagree with Sitchin's theory that evolution is true, because I don't think evolution is true. I don't think there's enough evidence to support it. I think what we're dealing with is a transdimensional type of terraforming technology, because that's just the way it looks to me. Like, it's more of an intelligent design, but without the religion. And so, you know, there's a lot of things, and the reason I'm saying this is that, you know, a lot of people accuse, well, you just believe in Sitchin, and you just take him hook, line, and sinker. No, I'm very critical of everything that Sitchin says. But the theme that he proposes with ancient astronauts, just like von Daniken did, it seems to me to be right on. It absolutely seems to just totally coincide with all of the artifacts, all of the, like you mentioned earlier, MK, out-of-place artifacts. You know, I think Neil Freer came up with a term and called it OOPARTS, O-O-P-A-R-T-S, out-of-place artifacts, things that are not supposed to exist around the planet, whether it be megalithic structures or little trinkets or devices like batteries.
A computer that they found out in the ocean, sunk in a sunken wooden ship from 100 centuries back.
Yeah, the Antikythera device.
It was full of really intricate gears. I mean, it was like a giant watch.
Yeah, how the hell can they make shit like that back then? There's no way. If evolution is gradualism, that had to have been introduced to humans by an advanced civilization. I'm sorry, the pyramids were not built by people. There's no way. I don't care how much people listen to Zahi Wash jack his jaw, the man is wrong, period. You know, they can't be duplicated. Where did the Easter Island stones come from? Where did the airport on top of the mountain that's just on top of the Nazca lines, how did they level off an entire mountain thousands of years ago? Had to have been an advanced civilization. And the evidence is just screaming all over the place. And I don't know how everybody can't see it, but, and actually I do.
I understand how it's not seen, and because it's not status quo.
Sure.
If there's not an answer that is in harmony with what's the current thinking, then they just don't consider it at all. Just it's there, you know. They'll look at the picture, and they'll scratch their head. But if it doesn't have any kind of a rational explanation, then they just let it go. They dismiss it.
I don't know that it's so much a rational explanation. But for example, for me to transcend Christianity, it took me. It was a requirement that I had to have something so fantastic as to happen to have almost run over a Sasquatch for me to get snapped out of the hypnosis. I mean, I don't think I would have ever left it, because I had to ask myself in those few moments that I, after passing this creature, holy shit, did I just see the missing link? WTF. What was that? And from that point forward, all I had was question after question after question, and it was just burning a searing hole in my mind. And I had to get
in. I understand why. I've had a few holes burned in mine by this film. Before we go any further, I want to take another minute to talk about the pictures that I have up here and just give a brief explanation. Under the animation that Mr. Mays was able to do for me, it says Creek 2 right arm. You see that what I was able to do with that fantastic frame that Mrs. Patterson let me have was to drive the two colors apart between the hair and the skin. Now, they're exaggerated, but they're driven apart. But you can only do that if they're not the same tone. If there's even a small difference between the hair and the skin, you see, I was able to drive those apart. That's color analysis, and what it does is separate the tones of the skin and the hair, and you can see the skin plainly beneath the hair. Even though it's much brighter than the skin actually was, it's artificially done so that you can see and delineate between the two, that you can see that this is clearly not a suit. So, you know, I wanted people to understand why that was had the appearance that it did. No suit would do that. No suit. A suit is monotoned. I mean, it's not. You're not going to be able to do that. That's a person. So. And one other thing, the RCP animation, it's taken from Blue Creek Mountain Road. This came out of the book On the Track of the Sasquatch, and I wanted people to look at that camera that's laying there on the ground. It's a large format camera, and it's got some writing on it, and what I see on it when I flip it upside down and do some enhancements is RCP. With the underlined, the CP underlined, and the fact that Roger Patterson's initials are Roger Clarence Patterson is not lost on me. So I'll leave it at that. Now back to Jason.
You know what was interesting about when you were talking about the Patterson film and taking the hair off the character? You know, I didn't know about this boxer from Russia until just this week. I believe his name is Alexander Fedorov. You know who I'm talking about?
I think so. I think I saw it on the internet.
Yeah, this guy is 7 foot. I mean, he's around 7 foot tall. But what's interesting, the shape of his face actually looks strikingly similar to Patty in some of those frames. And he is a big dude. You know, I mean, you know, we were talking about hybrids earlier, and it's just funny how some of the Russians, with some of their characteristics, with the wide jaws and you know, kind of like a short forehead with a heavy brow ridge, and pretty hairy, you know, like their body hair is substantial, and
right,
just hulking strength. It's like, wow, there must have been some inbreeding, you know, going back, you know, within the last several thousand years for sure.
Yeah, well, they're just now beginning to find that out. Remember a few shows back, we had Richard Substrat on here, and he was talking about the Denisovan genome being found in 4% of the Melanesian population. And that's a significant number of people that have that Denisovan gene. And now,
wow.
Now they used to think that the Neanderthals were gone. 1% of the population of Earth have Neanderthal genetics.
Well, there you go. That's a beautiful explanation for how hybrids. That supports the hybrid theory right there.
So they're not really gone. They're embedded.
Yeah, exactly. They're integrated into the culture. Yeah.
They used to call that in anthropological terms assimilated. And assimilation was often a method for saving yourself. You know, if you're about to die out as a people, a lot of times you would just go find another tribe and move in with them and assimilate. You know, and then if you check the genes 10 centuries later, you would find your gene in there with everyone else's, you know.
Right.
But surviving.
Exactly.
Well, I tell you, we got maybe about 3 more minutes. Do we have any emails?
Give me 1 second to bring them up.
Okay.
And we can go about 7 minutes over. We had a little technical difficulties in the 7 o'clock hour, so we're running a little late, listeners, but I'll be right back to you, MK.
Okay.
You know, if you got a minute here, last night I was told about a man who saw something here in the desert by Hawaii County. It was a cat of some kind or a dog, but he was running in the dark, and we're on an hour and a half moon crest, and he's seen it in the moonlight and the headlights of his car just right out in front running across. Keep going at 20 miles an hour, and it looked like an elongated body, much longer than I've ever had to describe before, of something running like lickety-split, like a cat or dog would do, right in front of the car. An estimated poundage was 90 pounds. Now, what did he see? And the colors were even unusual, blackish, and actually a blackish color more than anything else, but it was kind of like spots, not defined as round, but just blemishes on the animal. That's a new one to me. But this topic we're on to, it encumbers all kind of things besides bipeds, too, also. And that's where it's hard for me sometimes to talk on here because I got so much I'm finding out here. It's incredible.
Let me ask you something, Don. If you went to Puerto Rico and you saw an animal standing on its hind legs kind of hopping along with a great big wide open gaping mouth full of teeth and it's killing goats and chickens and what have you.
That's really on my mind, yeah.
What would come to your mind?
The chupacabra. But the thing is, it's also autosuggestive because that's what we heard they are called.
Well, let me go a little further here. I don't know if you know it or not, and this is recent knowledge, that there was a group of people, a society of people operating in secret in Tasmania who were exporting thylacines all over the world.
Well, I heard that before, and, you know, I was down in Australia in 2006, and I met this man at the university up there. It was a high school university, kind of called that. And he'd seen those, what they call the Tasmanian devil on several occasions, and they saw one we thought was also in Australia. and his home ground and northern territories, and he says it was not conducive to Australia. So yeah, they could have been shipped in there from that place. Now, he didn't mention way.
A thylacine has a plantigrade foot. It looks like a canine, but it's not a canine. It's more akin to the kangaroo, and it's got a mouthful of the worst teeth. I mean, they can open their mouth 180 degrees. And you know, if they were exporting them to any place they could get them from 1900 up until 1930, in similar environments,
I got your idea.
That may explain the chupacabra.
It might, and the teeth are all carnivore teeth, just that seem to have. And I've had the reports I told you about before in Idaho. I have two of them in the last 15 years. Twice in Idaho territory, those sheep men have seen something like that. And so they claim to have one. Anyway, it's interesting stuff. How can a person, in my case or any case, know so darn much about so many things? Because you're out there seeing things once in a while, getting the stories of why it's kept happening. We're not authorities on this stuff. Yeah. You get the stories all the time from people, and it's interesting to get so many of them.
Well, gentlemen, we did have a couple emails that have come in.
Okay.
I'm just reading them, fellas. First one says, will Artist First Radio hang up a Bigfoot cast from Don Monroe from Salt Fork 2008 in their studio to help heal the forest giants? And that comes to us from Saul. I'll let you guys handle that one.
Well, I didn't quite get that. I understand what you said there, Saul. I'm sorry. What's Don Monroe supposed to do?
Well, they're wondering if we will hang up a Bigfoot cast from you from Salt Fork in 2008. And I'm not aware that we've ever received any Bigfoot casts from you, Don, have we?
Casts? I don't know. I think I sent you some pictures one time. Quite a few, about 3 or 4 years ago. I never heard much more about it, but I have some casts I sent to you once, yeah. But I don't know if you ever showed them one anywhere. I've got over 150 casts.
Not the photographs, but the
actual plastered casts.
Right. I don't think you've ever
I never have sent you, but just pictures of them. Now, yeah, right on. I'm going to take some more soon, I think. And it's covert right now, but MK and I are about to go on a little trip here pretty quick. And the next show will be on here probably from where we're at. And I don't know. Yeah, well, I'd be glad to do what I can. Excuse my calves. They want one. I got a few of them I could share. No one's ever seen them. And they're extraordinary because of what they show that have been commented on by people who are authoritative on things that are pretty unusual. In fact, the one MK knows about, I'll mention it here, and it's a 24-incher. And I hate to even talk about it because it sounds incredibly impossible. We found 6 tracks to get that one. There were 4 witnesses on location when it happened. And that was in Idaho in the year 2006 in July or August. I forget which one it was. Later July. That cast has been, I've held it down because it don't sound feasible. But, you know, the more I get into this, it's not unfeasible. There's 22-inch tracks. There's 23s. There's 21s. A lot of 18s, 17s. I have those. But this is 24 inches. And, you know, it's incredible. You know, Ken Edens was with me. You know who he is, MK. And Ron Roseman was with me. And I have some people who are important in the they're trusted people, you might say. Yeah, and it's incredible what's possible to post in a show, but where do you do this thing? And I'm on the road so darn much I can't find myself home sometimes when I want to be.
What was the second email?
It's a comment from LT who writes, a comment to doubters. Sometimes the simplest explanation is often the truest. If it walks and talks like a Bigfoot, hey, maybe it is a Bigfoot.
Right on.
I'll have to agree with that one. I say, if we didn't have good evidence, you know, a story is a story, but a film is a film. You know, that documentary film has been used ever since film was invented to document, you know, actual things. We trust documentary film. We may never see exotic animals, but we see them on film, and so we know them by their images on film. And we don't question, you know, if the film has got enough behind it that you know that it's not a hoax. What I think, you know, the Patterson film, it just got mishandled, but it's no reason why it can't stand on its own right now. I'm way beyond does a Sasquatch exist? If the film did that for me, at least for me, I hope it did for other people too. Okay, it's 8:05. So, Jason, thank you for coming.
Oh, we are on the air now? I guess not.
You know, we're still on the air. We got about another couple of minutes. So
well, just one little thing quickly here to kill some time, I guess you might say. I'm on the desert out here in Arco, not Arco, but close to Arco, Idaho. It's in the vicinity of the Craters of the Moon. Check it out on your website if you want to, where it's at. It's a fantastic area. I'm going to be going in tonight to a hot springs that's not even known. It's only 150 yards off the highway. You got to know how to get to it. And it's a water pool with about 96 degrees temperature water, and it's raining tonight. And I'll be out there tonight with a towel and a molo out there having a good time in the moonlight. So there's places out there, places as well as things that people have no idea about it. And it hasn't been explored all because of the technology hasn't been at all.
Well, it's all about exploration, Don. I mean, we explore places, we explore our past, we explore with our minds, we explore with our eyes. Hopefully we've done a little bit of all of that tonight. I hope people have found this to be enlightening. Certainly,
thanks, Jason. Jason, thank you very much. It was a good show.
That just about winds it up, doesn't it? Scott?
It does. Folks, we're running about 10 minutes off schedule tonight. We'll be off schedule the entire live schedule this evening. Thanks, MK. Thanks, Jason Valenti. And thanks, Don Monroe, for another installment of Bigfoot Central on Artist First Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in, everyone.